नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि।
It's not necessary. This water's fine. So this is the third chapter from this collection of Lumpur Sumedha's teachings. And so this is originally from the book Chitta Viveka. And it's called Skillful Means, Listening to the Mind. In this form of meditation practice, listen inwardly and listen carefully. To listen inwardly, regard outside things as totally unimportant. Go beyond the concepts and thoughts. They are not you. Listen to that which is around the words themselves, the silence, the space. When you listen, what do you hear? Listen to the changing words as if somebody else was talking, saying, "I don't like this or that. I'm bored, fed up. I want to go home." Or listen to the religious fanatic or the cynic. Whatever the form or the quality of the voice, we can still be aware of its changing nature. You can't have a permanent desire. In listening inwardly, to the point where we are listening all the time, we begin to experience emptiness. When we listen to the voices of desire, we think they are us and create terrible problems for ourselves by identifying with them. We think there's a permanent personality or being with permanent greed. But in meditation, we can see that these voices arise out of the void. They arise and they pass away. Following the teaching of the Buddha, the practice is to know the known. To know what? What do Buddhists know? What does the one who knows know? The one who knows that these changing conditions are not self. There's not any eternal or soul-like quality, no substance in these things that one could call a permanent possession. The one who knows that what arises passes away. You don't have to know any more to be a Buddha. Being the Buddha means knowing by observing, not by believing the scriptures or me. See for yourself. Just try to find a condition that arises and doesn't pass away. Is there anything born that doesn't die? Be that Buddha who knows by putting energy into experiencing your life here and now, not by getting lost in the delusion of the idea of being Buddha. I'm the Buddha. I know it all. Sometimes desire even takes the form of a Buddha. Actually, there is no one who knows, and to conceive of being Buddha is not being Buddha. The Theravadins talk about anatta, not self, and the Mahayanists talk about shunyata, emptiness. But they are referring to the same realization. That is, one investigates and sees that the ego, the neuroses that we have, thoughts, greed, hatred and delusion, are all anatta. There is no self to be found, just empty conditions that arise out of the void and pass back into it, with no remainder. So we let things go, allow things to be as they are, and they change quite naturally on their own. You don't have to force them to do so. If you're experiencing something unpleasant, you don't have to annihilate it. It'll go away on its own. Self-conceit says, "I don't like this condition. I've got to get rid of it. Wipe it out." This creates a more complex situation than before. You're trying to push something away or bury your head in the ground so you can say, "Oh, it's gone." But that desire to get rid, vipava tanha, just creates the conditions for the condition to arise again, because we haven't seen that it dies quite naturally. We're sitting now in a room full of karmic formations, which we conceive to be permanent personalities. We carry them around like a conceptions bag, because on the conceptual level of thoughts, We regard each other as permanent personalities. How many things do you carry around with you, such as grudges against people, infatuations, fears, and events in the past? We can become upset just by thinking of the name of someone who caused us suffering over something that happened 20 years ago. How dared they do that? Treat me like that. Some people ruin the rest of their lives by carrying grudges around. But as meditators, we break through the pattern of memory. Instead of remembering people and making them real, we see that in the moment, memory and bitterness are changing conditions. We see that they are anicca, dukkha, anatta. They are formed in time, just like the sand grains of the Ganges River. Whether they are beautiful, ugly, black or white, sand grains is all they are. So listen inwardly. Listen to the mind when you're starting to experience pain in the body. Bring up the voice that says, I don't want this pain. When is the darn bell going to ring? Listen to the moaning, discontented voice. Or listen when you really get high. Oh, bliss, I feel so wonderful. Listen to the devata, celestial beings, indulging in bliss and happiness. And take the position of a silent listener, making no preferences between devata and devilish things. And remember that if it's a condition, it ends. Recognize things and let them come and go. They're just sankhara, karmic conditions that change. So don't interfere. The tendency of the modern mind is to think that there's some ogre lurking way down deep inside, just waiting for an unguarded moment to overwhelm you and drive you permanently insane. Some people actually live their whole lives with that kind of a fear. But a monster is just a sankhara, another grain of sand in the Ganges River. It's maybe an ugly sand grain, but that's all. If you're upset every time you see an ugly sand grain, you'll find life increasingly difficult. We have to accept the fact that some sand grains are ugly. Let them be ugly. Don't be upset. If you saw me sitting beside the Ganges River, looking at ugly sand grains, saying, I'm going to go crazy, you'd think, Ajahn Sumedho is crazy. Even a really ugly sand grain is just a sand grain. So what we're doing is looking at the common factor of all these different qualities, hidden monsters, latent repressed energies and powers and archetypal forces. They're all just sankhara, nothing much. If you take the position of the Buddha, being the knowing, we see even the unknown as just another changing condition. Sometimes there's knowing, sometimes not knowing. One conditions the other. The black hole, sunlight, night and day are all change. There's no self, nothing to become if you're being the knowing. But if you react to all the qualities of samsara, you'll become neurotic. That will be endless, just like reacting to all the sand grains of the Ganges River. How many lifetimes would it take to react emotionally to all the sand grains of the Ganges River, being ecstatic over the beautiful ones and depressed over the ugly ones? Yet, that's what people do. They dull themselves and become worn down and exhausted with this constant emotional turmoil and finally want to annihilate themselves. They may start taking drugs or drinking to desensitize themselves. But instead of building a shell and hiding ourselves away in fear and dullness, what we do is observe that none of this is self. So we don't have to desensitize ourselves. We can become even more sensitive, clear and bright. In that clarity and brightness, there is the knowing that, if it arises, it passes away. And that's what Buddhas know. So another wonderful, helpful teaching there from Lungpo. So this last little passage, what is it the Buddhas know? For a couple of years, that was a regular theme in his teachings. He would ask you, what is it the Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? And as a sort of a motto or a kind of ever-repeated theme. And you know, the implication being that a Buddha would have some kind of fantastic range of knowledge, or that they would have this extraordinary sort of degree of understanding, or a staggering array of facts about life, the universe and everything. But the answer would always be what Buddhas know is that all that arises passes away and is not self. And so this would be his Lumpur's way of bringing the attention back to the immediacy of the present moment, and also that the quality of Buddha knowing is the direct act of awareness rather than knowing about. So it's not a matter of accumulating facts about things, not that kind of a knowing, but the knowing that is embodied in the quality of awareness itself. Now that's the emphasis that he was always trying to make. Being the Buddha means knowing by observing, not by believing the scriptures or me. See for yourself. And then there's some reference to the sand grains of the Ganges River. I think this is, he's riffing on the theme of one of the, or some of the northern Buddhist sutras, where they talk about sort of living beings as innumerable as the sand grains of the Ganges River, which is a very sandy river. And it's got if you've ever been there, you'd recognize that that's an awful lot of sand grains. And then this image of watching the different sand grains and looking at them and examining them and sort of choosing the beautiful ones and getting ecstatic about them and rejecting the ugly ones as being depressing and awful. It's a way of highlighting how absurd much of our mental activity is, how we spend huge amounts of our day doing exactly that, saying, well, I like this thought, I like this emotion, I like this feeling, this perception, but I don't like these other ones. Coincidentally, I came across a reference to a book that somebody has just published about beautiful sand grains. sort of high magnification photographs of a very spectacularly beautiful sand grains. The whole book is just sand grains. But no, I'm sure there's no ugly ones in there. They are all perfectly chosen, beautiful, colorful and exotic sand grains. So this quality of listening to the mind and not picking and choosing or discriminating, that's a very much repeated theme of Lumpur Samedo, and it's a very, very important aspect of practicing Dhamma, where you're not, say, condoning your chaotic or confused or unskillful thoughts. You're not saying, oh, how wonderful, I just sat here all day, you know, hating Samanera and Nipapancho. What a marvelous thing. Yeah. You're not trying to make the something that's unwholesome wholesome, or pretend that the bitter is sweet. But you're able to recognize all those aversive thoughts arise in the mind, and that that's natural. If you have a body, you have a mind, then there's going to be a whole array of different experiences that come through. And so the process of listening to the mind, what he's saying over and over again is how the very act of listening, so being the silent listener, the silent watcher, the one who's just open to the flow of that, is learning how to not take our mind, our life personally. And so and that was the title of the most recent book of his teachings. It's called Don't Take Your Life Personally. And so just as we can get very personally involved with our particular memories or our thoughts or our emotions or our moods, if you took each one of those and sort of attach that to a sand grain and say, well, this is a really beautiful sand grain, that's a really good one, this is my sand grain, that's your sand grain, and this is a lovely one, that's an ugly one, it's ridiculous. And just as Lumpur paints this picture of him sitting by the Ganges River, choosing sand grains to get excited over and get irritated by or upset over, you know, it's ridiculous, but it's holding up a mirror to how much effort we make in our days, doing exactly that, just sitting beside the Ganges of our own mind, saying, oh, this is a really good thought, that's a really wonderful meditation, that's a really awful meditation, or my mind is all over the place, or wow, I've really got it together now, or I don't know where I am. It's just as ridiculous. And so that taking that position of, in a sense, being by the river and watching the flow, being with the flow of experience, that is the, as I think I was saying yesterday or the day before, that that very attitude of being attentive and open to the flow, whether it's beautiful, ugly, or neutral, that very quality of attention is the balancing agent. That's what helps us to say in the present moment, we're creating the causes for the wholesome and the noble and the beautiful to arise. That you can't control what's already been caused, you know, but we can, in this present moment, we can plant causes for what will take shape in wholesome and beautiful ways in the future. Oh, also a very common theme of Lumpur's is about idealism. Like when you're sitting and meditating and you're feeling pain, and the mind says, I don't want this pain. When is that darn bell going to ring? And he actually says, well, rather than thinking, oh, I'm an awful person, I shouldn't be so restless, I'm a lousy meditator, I shouldn't be waiting for the bell to ring, I should be patient, I should. He, as he points out here, actually bring up the voice that says that. Deliberately think it, rather than reacting to, oh, you know, the good meditator shouldn't be worried about when the bell's going to ring. Instead of believing in that ideal me that's not the same as this, just make the voice in the head louder. You know, make it clearer. Like, I want the bell to ring. If that bell rang, I would be happy. All my suffering would cease. I know. And when you emphasize it, you illuminate it, then in that very act of highlighting it, making it clear, getting it front center, then it loses its power. So it's only when those voices of the mind are sort of off in the wings, and that they're sort of murmuring away, that they have a lot of influence, because we're not hearing them clearly, we're not cognizing them fully. When we get them sort of front center, say, okay, speak up, tell me. What is it that you want? And then, well, if that bell rang and I didn't have this pain in my leg, I would be really happy. And then even as you form that thought, you know, well, within 5 seconds you'd be unhappy about something else. There'll be a feeling of relief, but then there's no guarantee that you're going to be happy forever. Of course, it's plainly obvious. But until you clarify that voice, that impulsive thought, then it carries on and has its power. So, do you have any particular questions or comments, reflections on all of that? Yes, Gabriel.
I noticed that about the things that the Buddha knows that will make people. You mentioned two of the good characters, but not suffering. Is that reflection of that? Does that make a thing to concentrate on one of those two as his main one?
You have to ask him. That was just his theme song for a couple of years. Was, what is it the Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? All that arises passes away and is not self. Yeah, just maybe it just rolled off the tongue one day, and then he just found himself repeating it. You know, there's no, I don't think there's any particular rhyme or reason behind it. He certainly talks about dukkha enough in other situations.
I can also ask about when you mentioned the five aggregates last night. You put consciousness as the last one, whereas some people, like Ayakama, mention sense consciousness as the second aggregate, with feeling, you know, so sense consciousness after the body, and then feeling, perception, and then formations coming out of that, which seems to make a lot of sense to me. So can you explain why usually consciousness is put as the last, you know, after all the thoughts and emotions?
Well, because in a way, I mean, there's all sorts of different ways you can interpret it, but generally speaking, it's describing a spectrum from the coarsest to the most refined. It's also, I don't think that sense consciousness is a particularly good translation for vijnana, because it also can be consciousness that's not connected to the senses. And so that it's just found its way into the chanting book here as being sense consciousness, but that I think is confusing in a way, because it's hard to distinguish what's the difference between sense consciousness and perception. So I feel it's much more helpful just to see vijnana as discriminative consciousness. And so then you have the spectrum of all the way from rupa, being the body or the world of form, material form, at one end of the spectrum, and then getting so that from the sort of your kind of large broken rocks over at this end to your gravel, then your fine gravel, then your coarse sand, and then your soft sand, and then your kind of self-raising flower at the at the far end. So you have like the, in a way, or another way of looking at it is sort of bringing the magnification from the coarse level down to a more and more and more refined level. So vijnana, literally, the vi means means partial or fragmented or discriminative. Jnana is knowing or knowledge. So it literally, well, one literal translation is discriminative knowing, or a knowing that divides this from that. So discriminative consciousness is probably the best term for it, rather than sense consciousness. It's got few too many syllables for the chanting. So and then people didn't like consciousness just on its own. So, but I feel that when you're talking about vijnana, it's the very, in a sense, the very fabric of cognizing. It's the act of cognizing of any kind. And so whether that's attached to the eye, ear, nose, tongue, or body, or whether it's in the mental realm and not associated with any other sense at all, it's that discriminative consciousness, that quality of knowing, dividing one thing from another. But you can reflect on the five khandhas in all sorts of different ways. And it's not, there's no sort of one set way. The Buddha deliberately used these sort of household terms. They're not sophisticated philosophical definitions, but they're like it's a rough grouping. So like the word khanda just means a lump or a heap. So rather like out in the builder's yard, you actually do get these different piles running up into each other. You got the broken bricks and the hardcore over there, and then you got the gravel, and then you got the coarse sand, the fine sand, and then the sort of super fine sand. It's all sort of, it's just this heap. You got the kind of broken rock heap. You got the coarse gravel heap, the fine gravel heap, and it's and then also he pointed out when someone said, "Well, can you divide feeling, perception, and consciousness? Are they conjoined or disjoined?" And he said, "You can't really." Well, it actually was a dialogue between the layman Visakha and one of the enlightened nuns in the Mahavidala Sutta, I think it is. And she says, "Well, you can't feeling, perception, and consciousness. They're conjoined. They're not disjoined." You can't divide one completely from the other, because that which you feel, that you perceive, that which you perceive, that you cognize, you can't entirely split them up from each other. Just like in a glass of water, you can say, okay, you can say it's got wetness, it's got temperature, and it's got fluidity. Yeah, can you take the wetness away from the viscosity? Can you take the temperature out? Well, no, you can't. But you can say, well, the temperature is not the same as the wetness. It's a different thing. But you can't just sort of take the wetness out and put it somewhere else. But the wetness is not the same quality as the temperature or the viscosity.
Perception means sort of naming and identifying, recognizing things.
Well, the way the Buddha defines it, in that same section of questions and answers, the way that the nun defines it, she says, Perception, it's called perception. Why is it called perception? Because it perceives red, it perceives yellow, it perceives green, it perceives blue. That's why it's called perception. So it's just very basic. It's not anything sophisticated. Like perceiving, it's like, oh, yeah, this is sort of, this is bluish, and this is white, that's green. It's just that designating, you know, those different patterns of sense experience.
And naming as well, isn't it?
The naming is slightly different, so that there's a perceiving of the difference before the thinking mind gives it a name, which is a vitaka, that says this is green. So there's a perceiving of the difference between that color and that color, and then the thinking comes in and says this is green, that's black. So there's the sense contact, and then sense contact, feeling, and then perception, and then naming. It all happens very quickly, but it's in terms of contemplating the five khandhas. I think it's very helpful in that little session of questions and answers it's made clear, you can't really divide it up. These are rough judgments, like a rough way of slicing the pie. It's not like, this is exactly what sanya is, and it's not anything else. And consciousness is exactly this, and it's totally different from sanya. It's like, no, you can't really divide them up. It's like, you can't really take the wetness out of the water and put it over there. You can say, yeah, it's wet. Or yeah, it's temperature's about 15 degrees. But that, yeah, you can say that. Those are meaningful designations, but you can't separate them out and say that the heat's over here and the wetness is over there and the viscosity's over here. Does that make sense? So the Buddha very almost always used these kind of very simple, rough sort of household terminologies for defining experience, rather than trying to have sort of all the kind of super refined definitions of Abhidhamma came along later. That's not really there in the main suttas of the Buddha. It's more like these simple, Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. Yeah, just these rough ways to slice the pie.
Did the Buddha mention, is it 89 different types of consciousness?
No. They're mentioned in the Abhidhamma, but you never find that in there.
So that's all commentarial, that's all.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. My opinion is that the Abhidhamma came along quite a bit after the Buddha's time. It has a whole different flavour than everything else, but they're staunch and sincere practitioners who will absolutely roll over several times in their grave or on their within their funeral, their urn full of funeral ashes, the idea that the Abhidhamma is not the word of the Buddha, particularly in Burma, which is kind of Abhidhamma central. Is that helpful? It's all a bit too tidy, you see, that it all lines up very neatly, and there's no loose ends, which should make one very suspicious. Because life generally has got a lot of loose ends. Yes, Chinta. There's about 9 different forms that it takes in various suttas. Different formats of it, or sometimes it begins at a few stages down the line, or you have an extra couple of things before, or it kind of leads on to some other things afterwards, or a couple of elements are left out. So I believe there's 9 different distinct patterns that you find. So again, there's the prevalence of loose ends makes you think, okay, that's likely. But in certain times, he talked about it in certain ways. He say avijja, ignorance, is the beginning of it. But there's also one sutta where he says, well, ignorance must come from somewhere. What's the cause of ignorance? And then he talks about the asava, or the outflows, as the cause of ignorance. But he only does that once. Other times he doesn't mention ignorance at all. And in the Mahanidana Sutta, he follows it back down to vijnana and nama rupa. Vijnana. Is that right? Yeah, vijnana and nama rupa, leaning on each other like two bundles of reeds. And the chain goes back to vijnana and nama rupa. And what conditions nama rupa, vijnana? What conditions vijnana and nama rupa? And so that kind of messiness or non-logicality or differences of approach, they're less tidy. So you don't get that kind of thing in the Abhidhamma, but you do in the suttas. And so it's much more like going through all these collections of Lumpur Samedo's teachings, you can find, I haven't found too many yet, but you're definitely going to find all sorts of inconsistencies where, you know, one page he says something and then 20 pages later he says the opposite. So, okay, that's that sounds realistic.
The way I try to reconcile all of these different sort of the way the Buddha has divided up codependent origination or the way we experience the world is just it doesn't seem to me that the Buddha is offering us a cosmology. It doesn't seem like he's offering us sort of a specific description of the way the world is, but he's offering us skillful heuristics to sort of frame experience so that we have a kind of framework where we can see the arising of cause and effect as we meditate, as we develop our mindfulness. So, what do you think of that? I mean, it seems to me that the Buddha is really not offering us something that we ought to contend with one another over, right? Be in dispute about fine-grained sort of divisions, but techniques or methodologies to try on as we try to solve this problem of suffering.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he does a certain amount of describing the world, but it's not, the main thing that he does is he points to, when he says the world, what is the world? The eye is the world, the ear is the world, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is the world. That is the world in the Tathagata's dispensation. So the world is the world of your experience, rather than there is this sort of fixed pattern of stuff happening as out there. So I think that's what you're talking about. And so it brings it right home to say, and this is the kind of thing I say often, is that we think we're sitting in the sala listening to these teachings or reflecting on these themes, but we forget that the sala is actually happening in your mind, that we piece together this moment out of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and we fabricate it as this. So each one of us has actually got a different pattern of experience. I mean, I'm facing west, you're facing east. we're looking in different directions. And and according to our own conditioning, the language that we speak, our own personal history, then that how the mind is conditioned, then it'll affect the different patterns that each of the representation of the world. And that the each one of it experiences, and in a way, the Buddha is like a phenomenologist. And so far as he said, the only meaningful way to talk about the world is to talk about the world as you experience it, to talk about an abstracted real world. Is a mistake.
That's the foundation of dispute, right? Existing world or non-existing world, right?
Yeah, well,
he's trying to lead us away from, it seems to me, away from that kind of engagement and trying to get us to focus on just this experience.
Yeah, exactly. So he's a pragmatist rather than a theoretician. So he's not trying to create a sort of perfect theory of how it all works, but more he's like a kind of a doctor rather than that's sort of trying to help you to get better, rather than someone who's sort of talking about medicine, but and how the body works, but is actually giving you the tools or the medicine that you need to get better. Yes.
Longpo always talks about the one who knows. So, from what I understand, it's because we're supposed to be one is watching the mind. And he says the one who knows when you watch the mind. So, is this the same mind that is clarifying the mind? Because when you're saying all these defilements are coming, these thoughts are coming, and it comes into the mind that thinking is done by the mind. So Longpo always says, the one who knows realizes that this is this and that is that. So is it part of the mind which is more refined that is watching the one part that is not so refined? Then he always quotes saying, the one who knows realizes this. So, from what I understood, that it's a more refined part that sees the unrefined and the defined part. Well, once I asked him, and he said, that's a very good question. This is one who knows.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. The sort of mind knowing it, it's mind knowing its own nature.
So the mind
and that the faculty of awareness or vijja, you know, is something that can always be accessed or drawn upon, and that the process of meditation, particularly insight meditation, is letting that quality of vijja or knowing be less and less entangled and identified with thoughts and feelings, perceptions, likes and dislikes, and the more sort of clear and unentangled and unconfused that quality of vijja, of knowing, is, then the more that there's the experience of clarity and peacefulness and integration.
So it's the same mind as we are wiping the dirt off from one part, which is clean, and then and therefore you can see what is going on.
Well, yeah, in a way it's the same mind, and in another way it's completely different. Just to make it very confusing. Because it's like the Ajahn Chah would use this image of oil and water. That normally, like if you have oil and water together in a bottle, and if you shake the bottle up, then the oil and the water, they seem to mix together. But that's only because of the agitation of the bottle. And so that's our normal state, the average state of attachment and identification. You know, I am the body, I am the personality, these are my thoughts, this is my life story, this is who I am. And these are my feelings, my attitudes, my ideas, my memories. So in that, all that I, me, mine is what's shaking the bottle. So it feels like I am these thoughts, I am experiencing, I am speaking, I'm hearing the sound of this voice, I'm feeling the body, I'm the one choosing these words. That's what's apparent when the quality of knowing and then the objects of knowing are all mushed up together. When you put the bottle down, then the oil and water separate out. They're both contained in the same bottle, in a way that, so to that extent, they're both aspects of the same mind. They're both contained in the same bottle. But then they set the two elements separate out. You have the quality of awareness, the knowing, the vijja, and then the objects of awareness. And that the fact that they are intrinsically immiscible, like they can't really mix. It's only through agitation and confusion that they seem to be mixed. They really can't be mixed. But it's because we keep stirring them up, they keep sort of mushing together. But as soon as you put the bottle down, then you don't have to do anything. They just separate out on their own because of their different natures. And so this was an image that Lumpur Cha would use very often to describe how you don't have to make wisdom transcendent over conditions. It already is. You just have to stop the agitation and attachment, the identification and clinging that keeps creating the feeling of I'm thinking, I'm feeling, I'm remembering, I'm planning. This is my mind, my body, my choices. And that when the bottle's put down, then the awareness, the knowing, and the objects of knowing separate out from each other. That's really an incredibly helpful and direct way of explaining vipassana meditation, where you're just putting your life down and learning how not to be interested in your own story and your own kind of ups and downs, and just let the objects and the awareness, the knowing of the objects, separate out from each other. And then they're both contained within the same bottle. They're known. They're happening in the same life experience, but the two qualities are intrinsically separate. And this was when Lumpur Cha met Lumpur Mun. This was one of the main teachings that he received from him. And again, it was a theme that he would talk about over and over again. He said that was one of the most impactful things, was that when Ajahn Mun said to him, the mind is one thing and the objects of mind are another, that that's why liberation is possible. If they weren't intrinsically separate, then liberation would be impossible. He said if that which was aware was part of the five khandhas, then liberation would be impossible. It's only because that vijja is transcendent, is not tied up with the five khandhas, then that means liberation is possible. Yeah, and the thinking mind tries to figure it all out and say, well, okay, how is it? What aspect of knowing is part of the five khandhas? What aspect of knowing is not part of the five khandhas? And so we can create a whole little labyrinth, a sort of tangled realm of conceptual thought trying to figure it out. But more important is just seeing how when there's clinging, suffering arises. When there's no clinging, then suffering ceases. And so that then, rather than trying to create the perfect mental model for how that all works together, you're bringing that quality of liberation into effect moment by moment. That's what makes a difference. That's why Lumpur Cha makes it extraordinarily simple. What is it the Buddhas know? That all that arises passes away and is not self. So that it's just treating the whole field of experience in exactly the same way. So just sand grains, that's all. That's it. Whether it's painful or pleasant, beautiful or ugly, wanted or unwanted, it's just sand grains. And then there's this that disentangling, quality of the spacious awareness that's holding everything. Okay, enough for today.
The last word in this, the quality of the spatial awareness, that sounds like holding, that's what you're like.
That contains everything. So tomorrow's reading is the five hindrances. So annamayam dhammakatha sadukaram dadamase sadhu.